Welcome to Oncology Today, managing transplant-ineligible newly diagnosed patients with multiple myeloma. This is medical oncologist Dr. Neil Love. For this program, I met with Dr. Saad Usmani from the Memorial Sloan Kettering Cancer Center. In addition to this audio podcast, there's also a corresponding video program with Dr. Usmani's slide presentation. To begin, I asked him to describe the current criteria to determine transplant eligibility in patients with myeloma. How do you look at deciding whether or not to go with transplant or delay it? And even in younger patients, are there situations where you're going to hold off on transplant?
It's a very important question. When I was a junior faculty, I was taught to think about age and comorbidities and performance status at the time of diagnosis. But I think that assessment has become more dynamic because the performance status of any given patient changes during induction treatment because we have such effective induction treatments. You may have someone who is an ECOG performance status of 3 and quite sick, but in a couple of months, as the cytoreduction happens and they're feeling better, their performance status would be different. So typically, I don't talk about transplant eligibility at the time of diagnosis, but during the induction process. I introduce the idea, yes, this will be an option, but let's talk about it a couple of months down the line. So performance status, comorbidities, how they're tolerating the treatment, and also paying attention to what their own goals are. We obviously share data around what the benefits of stem cell transplantations are, but patients may have other goals and may decide to collect stem cells and defer it for later. Even for younger patients, there are patients who may be young, but have significant comorbidities. So I think the transplant eligibility is not an age-dependent decision-making. And then more so in the last, I would say, 3 years, for any patient who's older than 70, I have a very low threshold to get my geriatric oncology colleagues involved for a comprehensive assessment. So a patient may look good to me with the eyeball test, but they might come back as an intermediate fit 71-year-old. And so when I have a transplant discussion with them, I would be talking about dose attenuation to their melphalan based on everything else that's happening with them. So I think it's become more of a dynamic process nowadays.
So we're going to focus most of our attention on people who are not really eligible for transplant because of age or comorbidities or frailty. But I am curious how you approach the younger patient who's totally eligible but just doesn't want to do it, maybe concerned about COVID, their work, their life, they want to delay it. Maybe they are MRD negative. I don't know how often that happens. That might factor in. What about the theoretical transplant eligible who doesn't want to be transplanted? How do you approach those patients?
I think at the end of the day, you have to comply by what the patient's wishes are, but you want to make sure that they are doing this in a well-informed fashion. So you talk about the existing data, the advantage of having a transplant early, the biologic rationale of why it makes sense to get patients into as deep a response as they can during that first year and then sustain it. So MRD negativity at one time point is not good enough to make that claim. And then you have data from Forte, from the Griffin trials that are showing you that the sustained MRD is what matters. That's what translates into PFS benefit. You can be MRD negative after induction, but fall out of that MRD negativity in the next 6 months if you take your foot off the pedal. And that will result in a lower PFS. So MRD is not a one-time point and done kind of a thing. It's more about sustaining that MRD negativity and what strategy gives your patient that best chance during that first year of diagnosis. And if they decide that they still want to defer because of their life goals and other things that are coming to play, of course, you comply by their decision by collecting stem cells, putting them away for later.
I'm curious, again, before we sort of dive into the other part of it, how you've observed COVID having an effect on the decision about transplant. You just moved from North Carolina to New York, and I can remember the beginning of the pandemic. I think that transplants were not being done at Memorial for a while. Can you talk a little bit about how that evolved historically and where you are today?
Certainly. So during the surge, and the same was true in North Carolina as well, we actually held off doing autos for about 8 weeks or so. But the reasons were a bit different. You needed capacity to take care of COVID patients. I think we had enough SOPs in place now to do them safely, even during the current surge. And that's what many centers are doing because of vaccinations and all the testing that's available, making sure that the patients are negative. But during the surges in 2020, there was a concern because we just didn't know. So I think it's less of a concern delivering standard of care treatment now than it was a year and a half ago.
That certainly kind of seems to be the case nationally. You mentioned the issue of geriatric assessment, and I actually set up, believe it or not, the geriatric education program at the University of Miami many, many years ago. So I spent a few years kind of diving into that, although it was a little outside of oncology, and it's like a whole thing there, really. And myeloma has always really taken a leadership role. A lot of research in myeloma about older patients. What is the median age of onset nowadays of myeloma? What do we know about the demographics in terms of age and myeloma? It has a reputation of being a disease of the elderly.
So the transplant ineligible patients make up probably a little over half of the patients that we see in our clinics. I think a significant proportion of those patients is fit or intermediate fit, but then a third, I would say, is the elderly frail. And that's the population where we are extrapolating data from clinical trials and trying to do dose modifications and managing them.
You know, it's interesting you mentioned clinical trials, because when you were giving your talk and you kind of mentioned that casually, I mean, everybody knows that you see very few elderly people in clinical trials in oncology in general. And actually, I was thinking about why. Why is it that we don't have elderly people?
I think when you put guiding posts around what the ECOG performance status needs to be and what the ejection fraction needs to be and whether they have pre-existing neuropathy, as you start adding inclusion and exclusion criteria to get a specific patient population, you kind of put that patient population, that more real world, older patient population aside.
Part of the thing that I have heard a lot of, again, I remember back to my days with the University of Miami there, when we were setting that up, is the issue of geriatric assessment. And you went through that in your talk. And I remember when I first heard about it, I thought, this sounds kind of like Mickey Mouse or academic or whatever. But the more I looked into it, the more validity it seemed to have. And I really like these sort of practical assessment things. Maybe you can talk a little bit about what your favored things. I mean, you can't do everything unless you have a geriatric program, which I know you're trying to set up at Memorial. But what are, from your point of view, what are the most useful assessment tools for you when you look at an older patient?
So I think the Stand Up and Go and the MiniCOG are probably the easiest to administer. And the clinic nurse can do this. It doesn't have to be the physician, and you can have that data ready for you in the room before you go in. So that's an easy screen test that you can do. It takes about 5 minutes combined for the nurse to do something of that nature, and very easy to do.
And what exactly do you do in this? I like that Stand Up and Go thing, because I'll bet you a lot of times you look at somebody and they look great, and then they try to do that and they don't look so great. It says you stand up and walk 3 meters.
Yes, and they have to do this within 10 seconds and see if they're able to do it. It's a yes and no, very simple kind of a test.
So they walk 3 meters, turn around and walk back.
Yes.
And I guess just the way they get up and stand and the way they walk probably is very informative.
Yes, because you're really relying on how much support they can give to their pelvic girdle. Do they have any proximal muscle weakness that will prevent them from getting up from that seated position? I think that's a very good indicator of their physical performance. And then a quick walk and back, it's a agility and stamina thing.
You mentioned nursing and other personnel that maybe do some of this evaluation. But, you know, we're hearing more and more about electronic monitoring of functioning watches and stuff like that. Also, you're seeing more studies looking at patients filling out electronic forms to give information. What are some of the things you're thinking about doing in terms of evaluation? In your talk, you brought up not only comorbidities, medication, but now psychological status, dementia, socioeconomic. There's a lot of things to gather. Do you think that people can give you information electronically in the clinic? How do you set something like that up?
So again, some of the information you can actually get in a face-to-face or an electronic questionnaire. So that to me is the easier part. I think that dynamic assessment during the course of treatment is the more tricky part. And this is where digital wearables become an important part. I mean, evaluating the possibility of using digital wearable technology to capture some of that information is probably going to be the key. One of my junior faculty, Neha Kordi, actually has presented data last year at ASCO and is kind of focused on bringing in those wearable devices and monitoring patients during the course of their treatment. So that would be an important potential piece to add to this whole assessment of older patients.
You know, your point is really a great one, that the real key is like what happens over time to these functions. Do they get better? Do they get worse? You mentioned that a lot of patients hope they're going to have improvement in their performance. Maybe your evaluation process will show that. Let's talk about the issue of choice of first-line therapy in the transplant-ineligible patient. Can you kind of summarize where we've been and where we are today in terms of that decision?
Certainly. So it all started with, I guess, melphalan and prednisone for the longest time before we switched over to the immunomodulatory drugs. First, it was Thaldex, and then the transition to Lendex as the standard of care based off of the first trial. Now, in Europe, there were trials that added thalidomide to MP and Len to MP, and those regimens were standard of care for a brief period of time. But in the US, within the ECOG, led this trial of Lendex with low-dose steroids versus high-dose steroids that really set up the stage of how we utilize the IMiDs in our older myeloma patients. So Lendex became kind of like the comparator backbone for subsequent studies, and whether it was VRD or DRD, that's how that whole schema evolved. So this is starting from early 2000s, going into 2010s, where now Lendex was established as an optimal standard of care. And then that's when the 3 versus 2 drug clinical trials started to be designed, including ELO Lendex, the VRD versus RD study, and then the Dara Lendex versus Lendex study actually was designed in the mid-2010s. So 2015 or so is when it started. But that's kind of like the timeline. So Thal in the early 2000s, Len making its way into the mid-2000s to late-2000s, and then the transition to the 3 versus 2 drug combination clinical trials. And that brings us to today. So that's how we're utilizing VRD and DRD as the two most common regimens that we use for the patients.
Can you talk a little bit about where we are in terms of incorporating Dara as part of upfront therapy in the transplant-ineligible patient? And right now, what are the common choices that people make in the first-line setting? It kind of seems like we're moving towards Dara in most, if not all, people upfront.
That's true. For the longest time, we as myeloma physicians have been telling our community colleagues that proteasome inhibition and immunomodulatory drugs are extremely important for myeloma patients. VRD is a great regimen. And out in the community, there is a comfort level with using that regimen for majority of patients, even for older patients with dose attenuation. And Dara is still relatively a new kid on the block. Having said that, for older patients, the DRD regimen is so much easily manageable compared to VRD. You don't have to worry about the neuropathy issue. It's the subcutaneous dosing as well that patients tolerate well. The only thing from a practical standpoint you need to manage is the Len dosing. That has to be adjusted for cytopenias early on in older patients. I tend to start with a lower dose of Len and see how they tolerate it, and then I can increase the Len dose. I would start at 10 or 15 and see how they tolerate it. But honestly, I mean, Dara is becoming a common regimen with Lendex in the frontline setting, but the uptake was a bit slow because VRD had been the incumbent for such a long time.
You also have VRD Dara, which is a choice that a lot of people embrace. And that also leads to the question of manage of the high-risk transplant-ineligible patient. How do you approach that, both in terms of use of proteasome inhibitor, choice of proteasome inhibitor, and also in maintenance?
Certainly. So to answer your kind of comment on your first point that you raised about Dara VRD, That regimen is utilized for transplant-eligible patients. We have no data in transplant-ineligible patients yet. However, there's a randomized phase 3 trial that's actually looking at that patient population. So it's called the Cepheus study, which looked at Dara VRD as induction compared to VRD. The schema is very similar to the SWOG 777 in terms of the standard of care arm. And then Dara has been added in the experimental arm of the study. I wouldn't be surprised if that study is positive. My only concern in the older patient population would be the infection risk. So with that being said, the second question you asked about high-risk disease, for high-risk transplant-ineligible patients, the PFS data that's impressed us the most has been incorporating proteasome inhibitor along with Lendex in the frontline setting, and then continuing proteasome inhibition as part of maintenance treatment. Whether it is in the transplant-eligible or the transplant-ineligible setting, there are several trials that kind of give us the same message. That is my bias of utilizing proteasome inhibitor-based triplet as a first choice, even in the older patients, coupled with the fact that DRD still hasn't shown a statistically significant improvement in PFS for high-risk patients in the MAIA trial data analyses. And I don't think that that will change because the proportion of high-risk patients was only about 15% in the MAIA trial. So the wealth of data is in the VRD cohort. Now, it's quite likely that with the Cepheus trial, the Dara VRD versus VRD, we might see a signal for high-risk patients in the quadruplet versus three-drug combinations. But my bias is still with the PIs.
So right now, outside of a trial setting, you do not use Dara RVD in a transplant-ineligible patient up front?
That's correct.
You think most docs in practice, same thing?
Yeah, docs in practice for sure. I think that they're picking a quadruplet for transplant-eligible patients, but probably not for ineligible patients.
I mean, you said you think that it's going to be positive, but I mean, I can't imagine at least the PFS is not going to be positive, right? Question is whether there's going to be a survival benefit.
Again, the trial, if it only has a follow-up for 2 or 3 years, I would be very surprised if we are seeing PFS differences that early on. I think that the key question in this patient population is, in addition to efficacy, is it safe to do it? And what would be the infection risk? I think I highlighted the older patient populations being at higher likelihood of hypogamma and recurrent infections. I think that would be an issue that we'll have to see.
You're saying there's an increased risk of infection because of adding a PI?
Yes, the PIs add a risk of infection, but if you add an anti-CD38 monoclonal antibody to any standard of care backbone, that increases the risk of infection too.
Dara?
Dara with ISA, across the board, there is a higher likelihood of infection.
What kind of infection?
I mean, essentially any kind of infection, but upper respiratory tract infections and pneumonias tend to occur more commonly. You can look across the board at all the Dara and isatuximab studies. And if you look at the AE column, you'll always find upper respiratory tract infections and pneumonias being higher compared to the standard of care arm.
Wow, interesting.
But it does not translate into any issues with survival benefit. It's just that the infection risk goes up.
Interesting. Incidentally, when you're talking about high risk and PIs, et cetera, how would you define high risk from that point of view?
So the way that we would define high risk today would include karyotypic abnormalities such as deletion 17P, translocation 1416, 1420, and a proportion of translocation 414. Then patients who have circulating plasma cells or extramedullary myeloma at the time of diagnosis kind of come into that category as well. We use the revised ISS staging system, but it is imperfect because it only incorporates a few, in fact, just 2 karyotypic abnormalities. So it really doesn't give us the complete picture. So the way I think about high risk is if you want to use the revised ISS, revised ISS stage 3, or a revised ISS stage 2 with a high risk karyotypic abnormality. That is true high risk. That's the flaw with the revised ISS staging system, that you can have someone with deletion 17P, but their beta 2 microglobulin is less than 5.5, and they fall in revised ISS stage 2. Those patients are still going to relapse within 2 years. It's the disease biology. Just because their beta 2 M is low, that doesn't mean that they don't have the high-risk disease.
So I want to ask you about a study that you were involved with. I always love these real-world studies because, of course, that's where we live in the CME world is out there. And you had this study, the USMM6, that looked at the integration of exazimib into the upfront management of patients who are transplant ineligible. Before I ask you about that and what you feel like we learned from that really interesting effort focusing on around 100 patients, can you talk a little bit about what, from your point of view, what we know about exazimib and particularly some of the clinical research data we have, particularly looking at it in the upfront and maintenance setting, but also in later line disease?
That study that you mentioned is very interesting, and it's very relevant to the early pandemic period as well. So the question that trial was asking is, can you switch to a prolonged proteasome inhibition in the older, newly diagnosed transplant ineligible patients, and whether that can help translate into a better survival outcome for that older patient population. So the trial allowed 3 cycles of induction with bortezomib, lenalidomide, and dexamethasone. But after that initial 3 cycles, the proteasome inhibitor was switched to exazimib. So now you were switched to an all-oral regimen. And that was both a community-based practical question that really came to the fore in 2020 when many of us were choosing to make that kind of a switch in someone who was on a proteasome inhibitor-based treatment who had already got to a good response. I think there's a strong scientific rationale for that.
I thought that was really interesting. The fact that I guess there had been a study using maintenance exazimib that was not as positive as people hoped it would be or not positive. But you were bringing up the issue that maybe in the long run, it might be equivalent because you can give it longer. And maybe you can talk a little bit about your experience with the drug. Kind of unusual to have a once a week agent. I was surprised too in the study that the adherence rate was pretty high to me, like 85%, particularly a once a week medication, which I think is a little bit tricky. So maybe you can talk a little bit about your experience with the drug side effects, but also how you deal with this issue, taking a drug once a week.
In the practical sense, my experience has been using exazimib in combination with Len in some of the high-risk patients during the pandemic where we had to make the conscious choice and switch so that we allow patients to stay at home and away from the healthcare setting. And I found the higher doses to be a bit challenging for patients, whether they're older or even transplant eligible and younger on maintenance treatment. But I found the dose adjustments to lower doses, 3 milligrams, is reasonably tolerable. Most patients would tolerate that, but probably not the 4 milligram dose.
What exactly is the problem? When you say they didn't tolerate, is it GI?
So GI side effects and fatigue are the two important ones. And then some patients do get the neuropathy as well, which can be a concern. How do I take those exazimib versus placebo trial data when we see the survival benefit of the long-term Len maintenance trials in front of us is the real question. I think when these exa versus placebo trials were started, it was a relevant question. The real question now is, can you do better with Len? Or can you do equal to or better than Len? Or would it be good to combine both and compare that to Len? Len is the incumbent. It's not placebo anymore. So I think that's the real question. I think there are a few clinical trials that are trying to ask that question now. And I think we will hopefully get our answer in 2 or 3 years. Right now, it's very difficult for me to pick IGZA over Len for patients based on the available data. I do combine both. If someone is not tolerating Len, for those patients, I'm comfortable utilizing exazimib.
Interesting. And from a clinical point of view, what kind of tolerability issues? You mentioned GI. What specifically do you see? You know, what's the time course? Is it a couple days after the treatment or when do you see it?
It's usually the initial 2 or 3 days when patients do get upper GI side effects as well as diarrhea. So upper GI meaning nausea, affecting their appetite, vomiting in some instances, and then loose stools the subsequent days. So as that pill is traveling down the gut, wherever it's getting absorbed, patients can get those symptoms. It's not constipation. It's more like gut irritation. And depending on the area of the gut tract, you get symptoms accordingly.
So going back to the general issue of the older or frail patients, I'm curious what your experience is just with corticosteroids and how you deal with that issue. You talked about RVD light and being modified, but one of the things you hear a lot about, of course, is corticosteroids. What's your experience with it and how do you deal with that?
My preference is to dial down the steroids fairly quickly in older patients. For patients who are 75 or older, we start with a 20 milligram dose and then we can reduce it to 12 milligrams for subsequent weekly dosing. I tend to discontinue steroids within 4 to 6 cycles in older patients as they're getting closer to as good a deep response as possible, and then just keep them on the other two drugs.
Also in your talk, you brought up the issue of choice of proteasome inhibitor and, of course, the Endurance trial that compared carfilzomib to bortezomib. We've gotten a little bit beyond that, but still, I think, a relevant issue. I still get questions about carfilzomib and particularly carfilzomib in high-risk patients. Can you just review what was seen in the Endurance trial and particularly the difference in the side effects profile of the two drugs?
Certainly. So in terms of overall response and PFS, they were similar. The cardiac, the renal, and pulmonary side effects, so cardiac primarily being drops in ejection fraction, arrhythmias, pulmonary being pulmonary hypertension-related symptoms, and renal being essentially acute renal insufficiency, ATN kind of thing. So they were seen in about 16-odd% of the patients, grade 3 or higher in carfilzomib. That's not inconsistent with what we already know. The authors have not shared a lot of details around the patient profiles of who actually got those kind of symptoms. Was it in all older patients? Did they have pre-existing issues? But we've looked at that. We've tried to do that profiling in other carfilzomib studies. There are patients who have no cardiac history who develop cardiac arrhythmias or ejection fraction drops. So it's hard for me to say that, which patients I would pick K over V. And then on the other side of the spectrum, the profile of peripheral neuropathy with bortezomib-based regimens is very well established. So we don't really need to dig into that. In the Endurance trial, we saw the same thing, a little over half of the patients getting peripheral neuropathy of some degree. For high-risk patients, most of the data that we have is in the phase 2 or randomized phase 2 space. High-risk patients were excluded from the Endurance trial because there was another high-risk study that was enrolling at the same time in the cooperative group setting, and that's where the high-risk patients were going to. So we don't have any high-risk data from this data set. I think the only information we may have is with chromosome 1Q21 amplification patients, where there appears to be a benefit for the GAIN patients, but no benefit for the amplification patients. So those patients who had 3 copies of chromosome 1Q21, carfilzomib-based combinations may be a bit better, but those that had 4 or more copies, there's no difference.
Any comments on the PI-related neuropathies that are seen? Any pearls for people in practice in terms of management? You see a lot of people who've been, you know, second opinion managed in the community. Any thoughts about peripheral neuropathy?
Early recognition is the key. I think with the subcutaneous weekly dosing, we are seeing less intense neuropathy in terms of grading. But the key is recognizing neuropathy early and dose reducing or modifying the schedule early on. If you have a patient who is coming with painful grade 2 neuropathy after 2 cycles of treatment, the likelihood that neuropathy will stay with them over the rest of their life is fairly high. So why wait until patients develop those symptoms? Just pay a bit more attention to their symptomatology in that first and second cycle and modify the doses. And then I guess a part of the onus is also on how we educate patients and how patients relay those symptoms to us as well. So making sure that the patients are well educated to watch for the right symptoms so that they can come up to you and say, hey, I'm developing these funny feelings. Is this due to bortezomib?
I know that you have, I think it's a complimentary service there at Memorial that's really done a lot of great work. Anything on neuropathy that you've seen? Do you hear about gabapentin? You hear about acupuncture? Anything that you're using there or that group is looking at?
No, I mean, we typically have utilized the usual pharmacologic agents. Acupuncture can be a blessing for some patients, but it's a hit and a miss. And then many times, functional physical therapy training helps. So if someone has neuropathy that's not going away, I think having them train to live with it and get help from physical therapy can be a big help for many patients.
So let's chat a little bit about your vision or thoughts about where myeloma is heading. Really exciting time. I was pretty excited when RVD came along, but what's going on right now makes that look pretty slow, actually. So one thing I was going to ask you about, we were talking about transplant eligibility. We just saw at the ASH meeting maybe the beginnings of a movement in diffuse large B-cell from autologous transplant to CAR-T. There was two positive trials presented. A lot of people are talking about it. Do you see possibly that happening in myeloma in the future?
I do, actually. And I'm really looking forward to that revolution coming to the myeloma field as well. So there are going to be studies that evaluate CAR T cell therapy after induction for even older patients. I think CAR T eligibility criteria is very different from transplant eligibility criteria. We have older intermediate fit patients who can get CAR Ts who would not be eligible for a stem cell transplant per se. There are actually active trials right now that are actually looking at frontline CAR T in that setting. There will be trials that compare autologous stem cell transplants to CAR Ts that are going to start very soon as well. So I think the whole paradigm will change in the next 5 to 6 years in terms of the induction treatments that we're utilizing and what kind of consolidation we're giving, whether it's going to be an auto or a CAR T. And the other important change that will likely happen as we're bringing CAR Ts is we will likely define the duration of treatment with sustained MRD negativity. Maintenance will not be for all patients. It will be for only a subset of MRD positive patients. The third thing that I think we briefly touched upon is the possibility of having just an antibody-based treatment regimen for patients. So a combination of either a naked antibody with an ADC or a naked antibody with a bispecific that gives our patients the same bang for the buck, without having to add steroids or PIs or IMiDs.
Yeah, I was kind of surprised. I was talking to Dr. Berjeha, and he brought up the issue of using belantamab upfront and in combination, and that there are more and more trials looking at it in combination, which I thought was really interesting. I never heard about that. Do you see where belantamab is heading? Do you think that could end up as part of induction therapy?
So there were data that I had presented at ASH combining belantamab with VRd for transplant ineligible patients in a phase 1 study. There are data from the Greek myeloma group looking at belantamab with Lendex in that frontline setting as well. So some of these early data are kind of looking promising, and the belantamab dose and schedule is different from what it's currently approved at. It's at a lower dose and it's being given less frequently. So the likelihood of getting the ocular side effects is a bit lower. The profile appears to be a bit more safe compared to what we saw in the relapse refractory DREAM 2 study.
So in terms of tolerability of belantamab, particularly the eye issues, any difference in older or very older frail patients, more of a problem or pretty much the same?
No, it's the same. So within that patient population, I think it really depends on what the social situation is and how independent that older myeloma patient is and how much do they rely on themselves to get them from point A to point B, whether they're driving or whatnot. So depending on what their goals are, we would have the choice of picking the right partner drug or therapies for our patients in the future.
The issue of eligibility for CAR-T, we talk about all the time, and often we'll contrast it to autologous transplant, because that's often, for example, that's what happened with diffuse large B cells we were just saying. And I'm just curious, though, what the bar is that you use in terms of CAR T for myeloma. It seems like it doesn't have as much toxicity as the CD19 agents, say, for example, in lymphoma. So for practical points of view, what are you looking for? Is there an age, for example, in an otherwise healthy patient where you won't do CAR T? And are there specific comorbidities that you're looking for, like cardiac, et cetera, that even push a patient farther down?
I think the cardiac and renal function would probably be the two big ones. And the threshold for the renal function, again, it would be dependent on what the inclusion criteria of the clinical trial was. I think I will not exclude patients just based off of age alone when it comes to CAR Ts. I know that on some of our trials with both cilta-cel and ide-cel, we have treated patients who are in their early 80s as well with CAR T cell therapy. So age won't be the limiting factor there. It would probably be the cardiac and the renal functions.
We had a patient present the other day. I can't even remember what the tumor was, but I remember he was 94, he was jogging, and he was on no meds.
That is remarkable.
I know, no meds. Oh, that was me. Of course, the other thing is bispecifics, because now you're going even lower in terms of tolerability. I would think that the average, even frail elderly patients, I don't know how bad the cytokine release is with those, though.
So cytokine release happens in about well over two-thirds of the patients, but it's grade 1 and 2 for almost all patients. Grade 3 or higher happens in a handful of patients. And we've come to become very good at managing CRS in our patients. We recognize it early and pull the trigger early on supportive care measures. And you're right, the safety profile is very different from the CD19 CAR experience. The BCMA CARs appear to be much more tolerable compared to that CD19 experience in B-cell malignancies.
Initially, I was getting the impression that it was more tolerable, but maybe less effective. And now it's kind of looking like it is really effective, particularly some of the cilta-cel work, and you've been very involved with that. And I just have to ask you, I know we just had ASH, anything new on the non-ICANS neurotoxicity with cilta-cel? There's been so much interest in that. And I know initially, I think there were a bunch of patients that had that, and then it looked like it was less, and then there was some new data presented. Where do we stand right now with these movement disorder things?
So they were observed in a handful of patients, 5 patients in the original CARTITUDE 1 trial. And what was observed was patients who had a high burden of disease or had high-grade early CRS or ICANS were the ones who would develop this delayed side effect. And based on that experience in the subsequent cohorts and in other CARTITUDE trials, if bridging therapy was allowed, early recognition of CRS and ICANS led to managing those symptoms or those side effects early. And we did not see the neurocognitive issues in subsequent patients. So I think it's about, if we're asking too much from the CAR T in terms of disease burden or not recognizing and managing CRS or ICANS early on, that's when we were seeing this. So if we do our due diligence, we're not seeing that side effect anymore.
That's interesting. So more aggressively managing the ICANS and CRS, you see less of the movement disorder?
We see almost none. And that's what's been reported in the CARTITUDE 2 experience.
You mentioned bridging therapy. For practical purposes, like how do you decide? Do you use it in everybody? Or how do you decide whether to use it?
Most of us use bridging therapy for our patients after having collected their T cells and while we're waiting for the T cells to come back from manufacturing. That period can be 4 or 5 weeks. So depending on the disease burden, we might give the patients a dose attenuated DCEP or PACE regimen, the infusional chemotherapy, or we might give them a PI cytoxin-based regimen to kind of cytoreduce them during this time. What you don't want is the disease to be going as you're trying to infuse CAR T cell therapy, because that's where you're going to see a lot of CRS in those patients. And I think it's the same experience even with the CD19 CARs as well. If you have someone who has quite proliferative lymphomas and higher burden of disease as you're getting them to lymphodepleting chemotherapy, the likelihood that you're going to get higher grades of side effects is higher.
Do you have situations where, because of a lack of benefit with bridging therapy, you decide not to go forward with CAR T?
That hasn't happened in my practice.
Because everybody responds?
Yeah. So typically, if you have that kind of a concern about someone who has aggressive disease biology, you are going to be utilizing DCEP or PACE. And those regimens are really good at knocking things down. Now, the disease won't stay down forever, but you will knock it down long enough for the CAR Ts to do their thing.
This concludes our program. Special thanks to Dr. Osmani, and thank you for listening. This is Dr. Neil Love for Oncology Today.